This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by RPGNow.com, your leading source of PDF game products, GamersAddict.com for your hard copy of game books, dice, and more, and listeners like you. Thanks for using The Tome's Amazon store and RPG Shop affiliate link.
This is Eitan Bernstein, author of Dragons of Feyre and the Magic Item Compendium and Exemplars of Evil, and you're listening to The Tome.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 112. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interviews show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. And by the Iron Fist of Bane, choking out the breath of those too weak to take power for themselves, this episode will explore divine power. And for our exploration of divine power, we have an old standby with Will Wong. Welcome back, senior Tome contributor. And we also have Quinn Murphy returning from the Atwill blog.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
And we have a newcomer, Jake Fitch, who also contributes to the Atwill blog. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
We're always happy to have new folks on. This is the first episode I've recorded since my return from Africa, so I'm maybe a little bit rusty, as the guests here have already heard, as I've done some things that everybody else won't hear, because I'll edit it. But now that I'm back, I'm quickly trying to put together some new episodes, plus do some other podcasting and D&D-related projects that I will be sure to announce when I have some things actually solidified again, hopefully before my school year starts in a few weeks and I start getting much busier. But that's the future. Today, we're talking about Divine Power from Wizards of the Coast, written by Rob Hinsu, Richard Baker, Logan Bonner, and Robert J. Schwalb. This is the latest in a series of power-based books that are intended to expand your options for playing characters of that power source. We've had martial power and arcane power, and since Player's Handbook 2 has doubled the number of divine classes from 2 to 4, we can now get out the divine power book and increase our play. But before we get too far, let's take a look at our first sponsor, RPGNow.com. My pick for this episode is the Ultimate GM Screen 2 from Fat Dragon Games. I'm currently actually about halfway through the process of building this screen myself. Be warned, it is a fairly complex task, but they do make it as easy as possible with their detailed instructions. You'll end up printing a lot of cardstock pages, but you end up with a screen that looks like a castle, has shelves in the back for storing minis, and towers that will randomly roll the dice for you. At $10, this is a really fun project, and in the end, will result in a much more complex gaming screen than I've ever had before. And you can get it from RPGNow.com. Has anybody else seen the Ultimate GM screen before?
I've seen pictures of that, but I did not know that one could get the schematics of it. That is actually exciting, and I'm probably going to go pick that up.
Yeah,
I want to try that out.
I've never done any of the Fat Dragon Games sort of three-dimensional terrain things before. I've always sort of thought about it and wanted to look into it, and so when I saw the opportunity to grab this one, I did, and I'm doing it, and as a first project, it's fairly complex. I'm struggling a bit with the first of the two towers that I'm building. Go ahead.
I've done a couple of the projects before, a couple of the buildings and stuff, and I find them really fun to do and kind of listen to podcasts in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And they add quite a bit to the gaming session when you pull out this building that people are actually walking into.
Yeah, that's cool. But that said, you want to make sure you get some time out of it. You know, use it over and over again, because if putting together one of those buildings takes half the time that it's taking me to put together this DM screen, it is a bit of an investment.
Yeah.
But very, very cool.
It does look pretty cool. I had never seen one before. I pulled it up online.
And I'll let you know more when I finish it up.
Get the newest releases at RPG Now. Only at RPG Now can you get the absolute latest and best releases from fantastic publishers like Palladium Books and White Wolf Publishing. There are new products every single day. Come to RPGNow.com and get them the instant they're available.
But for now, let's go ahead and move along to our discussion of Divine Power. Now, we're going to sort of run through each of the chapters. The first four chapters of which are basically giving you more options for a different divine class, going through Avenger, Cleric, Invoker, and Paladin. And then the last chapter is just the divine options that gives you backgrounds, domains, feats, destinies, rituals, all these other fun things. So the first chapter is the Avenger chapter, and as has become sort of the norm for these power books, you get a chapter with a class, and that includes a new class feature that allows you to have a new class build. The new class feature for the Avenger is the Cincture of Unity. What do we think of the Cincture of Unity?
It's like the other Avenger cinctures. They're weird because the Avenger ones, when I look at them on the paper, I'm like, this seems very impractical. And then if you get a chance to play an Avenger, it completely works and is very cool and sort of like rewarding, like very tactical positional play. So I haven't played this one yet, but I would anticipate that it would look really good on, looks better on the table than it does in play. It looks better on the table than it does in the book.
Sure. And this one is basically the Cincture of Unity gives you a bonus to damage against your Oath of Enmity target when your allies are surrounding it. So the more your party is able to gang up on your Oath of Enmity target, the more damage you're doing.
Yeah, and that, I'm going to skip ahead a step to the Bonus Seizure or Censure, which is their new at-will for this class feature, which actually allows you to pull the creature into the midst of your allies, which to me would make it quite damaging. Yeah. You pull it right into the mob of you guys.
Yeah, when you combine it with some of the powers that play off of that ability better, you can really sort of see that happening a lot and coming up a lot. Speaking of other powers, is there any other Avenger powers that we want to sort of highlight as going really well with this new class feature or just really cool Avenger powers? I know I'm looking forward to digging into these a little bit more in detail because I'm currently playing an Avenger, but I haven't really dug in to see anything that sort of shines out of saying, ooh, I need to retrain that next level. So what am I missing? What should I be looking to retrain into next level?
Well, I saw a couple good powers for pursuing Avengers in there.
Mm-hmm.
One being the first level daily Wings of Light, which allow you to basically sprout wings and fly over to your, to wherever you need to go, to your Oath of Enmity's target.
Yeah, right on.
And you don't provoke attacks from opportunity from that either.
And that matches very well with my specific Avenger, who's a Deva, and is also a spell scarred, and has the wings of blue fire that he likes to pop out every now and then too. It's just more wings. He's very angelic that way.
Yeah.
Bring out the flying. The one that highlights the power, and it's real early in the class there. You can get it at the first level daily. Strength of Many is, if you set that up right with a bunch of your allies, you sort of dog pile on someone. If you're looking at a pretty huge damage bonus, basically what it does is next damage roll you make, for the end of your next turn, you get a +2 to your damage for each ally within. And this one isn't even adjacent. It's within two squares of you.
Mm-hmm.
So you can sort of draw on, it's sort of like drawing all that power. And it starts at 3W. to begin with. So that one can get pretty huge pretty fast, combined with the sensor of Unity.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of what the new build for the Avenger is doing when you start looking at the powers is it addresses some of my concerns that I had when the Avenger was introduced in Player's Handbook 2, in that the Avenger naturally feels like a class that doesn't necessarily play well with others. You know, it's a class that's about running off and doing your own thing and not really working with the party, which is counter to the philosophy of 4th edition.
Right.
A good way to get killed.
But this Avenger build is all about working with your party. And it also, the Avenger feels a little bit less strikery to me than most strikers. But this is giving you more bonuses to damage, which makes it feel a little more like a striker too. So I almost feel like this one is a reaction to this build, I guess, this concept is a reaction to the fact that the previous builds for Avengers didn't really feel like they fit as well into the 4th edition philosophy.
Yeah, I can see that.
Are there any sidebars? A lot of times in these books, one of the first things I'll do, you know, I might skim through powers, but I'll read the sidebars word for word because there's a lot of interesting little tidbits in those little nuggets of text. Was there anything you saw in the sidebars for Avengers that seemed particularly exciting to you?
Whom to hunt. Oh, sorry. Go.
Go ahead.
Whom to hunt. That one, I love that one because it's basically like your enemies list. Yeah. You know, like a samples enemies list. You know, if you worship, you know, Corlon, then you're hunting Drow and Fomorians and Lolth worshippers. Like, you know, sort of who do you hate specifically? Was kind of cool.
It almost feels a little bit like the old list for Rangers. That had the favorite enemies back in the older editions, and it, you know, it was sort of if this is your god, these are the things that you might be interested in going out and taking on.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, go ahead.
Another one that I found interesting was the serving multiple masters one,
mm-hmm.
which basically says that your Avenger or really any of the divine classes can serve multiple gods. Which I found is an interesting concept that they have in 4th edition, where even a cleric can be a cleric of multiple gods.
Yeah. Well, and that really plays into... I mean, it's almost like they wrote this chapter for me as somebody playing an Avenger who's playing a Deva. And the storyline of my Deva is that he came to the mortal world to seek vengeance for the god that he was working for in the astral plane who had been killed. And so now he's serving a second god because it's sort of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. I'm going to go serve this god to get revenge for my previous god that was killed.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, I read through that and it's like, wow, this is just right down the alley exactly of the kinds of things I'm looking to do with my Avengers. What do we see in Paragon Paths that excites us? Or doesn't?
I wasn't terribly excited with much of the Avenger stuff.
Well, there's the favored soul, which gives you wings all the time.
Which is always fun.
Yeah.
And then Jeff's character can have 6 wings.
At one time? I could totally do that, too. That would be awesome. Now, a lot of them seem to be, you know, you have a lot of them. It seems like about half of them are just prerequisite Avenger. And then the other half are Avenger with a certain kind of class feature, the Cincture of Pursuit or the Cincture of Unity or what have you.
Yeah.
Just trying to play up the different aspects of being an Avenger. And it really highlights, I mean, some of the different directions you can go with an Avenger. Some of these are very sort of bright and shiny, angelic sort of creatures, and some of them are more like holy assassins.
Yeah, like one I'm looking at right now is the Relentless Slayer. Which they're, what is it, level 20 attack power. You assume a Slayer's stance. Until the stance ends, you make a melee basic attack once per round as a minor action. Which, to me, is just pretty powerful.
Right on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the one that sort of stood out for me amongst, like as you were saying, you sort of have, like, you know, you sort of have the good Avenger, Paragon Path, and then you have the bad Avenger Paragon Path, and then you have sort of somewhere in the middle the Gambler one, the Weapon of Fortune, which is the last one in there.
Yeah.
I like this one just because it was like, is all these options you can sort of make gambles like for their 11th level power. You can spend an action point, and then you can choose to roll a d6. And if you get a 6, you get the extra action, but you keep the action point.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, like all sorts of like interesting options like that. And then they have powers where you sort of choose to sort of roll. And if you roll well, you know, you get a benefit. And if you roll poorly, you get messed up.
And I was gonna say, I really like that there's so much variety in the Paragon paths for this. I mean, you can be the Relentless Slayer or the Weapon of Fortune or the Favored Soul, and they feel very, very differently, which fits well for a class that's supposed to have this individual sort of relationship with their deity. Mm. You know, so if I'm following a god of luck, the Weapon of Fortune makes a ton of sense. You know, if I'm following a god of protection, then the Watchful Shepherd makes a lot of sense. And so that variety allows you to pick a Paragon path that's going to play into the role of your Avenger and their god.
Mm-hmm. And none of these...
Go ahead, Will.
I was just saying, none of the paths require any specific deity or, I guess... They call them portfolios. Like your Avenger could be an Avenger of Cord or Palor or something.
Yeah.
And he could still Paragon into Weapon of Fortune.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they could. They're not requiring a lot of that stuff. But they could. You can still sort of flavor your character that way if you choose to. And a lot of times I think that's a better option than requiring it. Just because you're taking a flavor aspect and giving making it a mechanical requirement. And that's sometimes a tricky line to walk.
Well, and sometimes you want to be the Avenger of the Light God, but be the Dark Assassin for him.
You want to be Batman.
Yeah.
That's what being the Avenger's all about.
Right.
Pretty much.
Being Batman. So, what's the cleric all about? The cleric has a new class feature, and this new class feature seems to be taking healing and ratcheting it up to 11. Man, I am out of practice, aren't I?
I blame Africa.
Yes, it's Africa's fault. So, the new cleric class feature gives you a new type of channel divinity called Healer's Mercy. Where each target can spend a healing surge, but you are weakened. So you sort of take on their pains on yourself, and it hits any of your allies who are bloodied within 5 squares. So, I mean, it's really good for healing.
Yes, it is an excellent healing ability. My problem with it is I've seen Turn Undead just... wipe entire encounters before, and losing and Turn Undead for this, I'm not sure. You'd have to be a very healing specialist to want to do that.
And that runs right into, you know, like you do something like this if you're going to be a super healer, and running all the way to the end of the book, if you pick the pacifist healer theme, that one, you basically become a super healer with some real big penalties, you know. I sort of cheated and went ahead there. But, you know, they finally made... I remember hearing a lot on Twitter and just talking to various people where people... A lot of people were really missing just the sort of, like, backline ultra healer. Like, that was all you did. And you were really good at it. And now they brought that back with this. So everybody can stop complaining about that.
Yeah, well, and the cleric was already the best healer in the game. And now with this build, you can really, I mean, it's healer to the extreme. I mean, you can potentially heal every member of the party with one power that's an encounter that you get to recover.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then you're getting other things that also there's more powers throughout the new healer bit here that also gives you more healing abilities. So I mean,
yeah.
this book really makes the cleric a super healer in a lot of ways, yeah, if they want it to be.
Which is again kind of counter to the 4E mindset of everyone being able to attack things, but yet branches out the options to add more things into the game. So I think it's definitely a good option.
Well, and it still keeps the cleric involved in hitting things. You know, for example, one of the new at will powers is Recovery Strike. It's the cleric makes a strength attack versus AC, does a little bit of damage, one weapon plus strength, but the next ally that hits that same target recovers a little bit of hit points. You know, without using a surge, which is huge. Anytime you can get hit points without using a surge.
Oh yeah, definitely.
That's huge, and to be able to do that at will, can be pretty significant.
Yeah,
Well, if you look at the other at will power, which is Astral Seal, you're doing Wisdom plus 2 versus Reflex. It's a ranged 5 attack, and you don't do any damage to it at all. You're just giving it a negative 2 to its defenses, and the next ally who heals, you give it plus 2 plus your Charisma modifier hit points healing. So you're at will healing people for a nice little chunk.
Are there any other cleric powers that stand out to us as something we want to highlight?
I have Return from Death's Door. It's another low-level power one, but it's awesome. It's basically, I've seen, in one of my games that I run, we have two leaders, and that party is hard to put down there's just too much healing. And then they have, extra powers like this, where basically any ally within 20 squares of you fails a death saving throw, and you basically go, nope, actually you succeeded the death saving throw and you get a healing surge.
Sweet.
Like an instant up. Another power that's just, if you invest in that, it's a utility too, just makes once a day someone just, come back to life. It's pretty awesome.
Sweet. Any sidebars that stand out as interesting? The cleric sidebars to me seem to be much more specific in their usefulness. There's the one that's all about how do you play a dwarf that doesn't worship Moradin, and which is useful if you're playing a dwarf and want to do something a little bit different. But if you're not, it's a little bit less useful. There's one that's on small devotions, and it's just sort of the little things that a cleric might do that helps flavor your campaign, and that one sort of works for me in terms of being useful to all clerics.
That kind of stuff is important.
Well, and I think it more than any mechanics, it helps you feel like your cleric is of a specific faith or is a specific personality. That's where the role playing comes into the game. And what paragon paths do we see? Well, here's the first thing I noticed when I opened up the cleric paragon paths. They've recycled art again. It grates on me every time I see it. And the art is fine, but it's the same art that they had in third edition books. I'm specifically looking at the Anointed Champion. The very first paragon path for the cleric is recycled art.
I never noticed that stuff, so.
I do sometimes.
So I did notice that the guy back on page 32 looks like the guy from Final Fantasy.
Oh, I could see that, sure.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So, Quinn, what paragon paths stand out to you?
I am a Messenger of Peace. I am a Messenger of Peace fan. It's another one, I've talked about this. My fixation for the cleric, I instantly sort of saw it and sort of like looking at all the things that fit into it, is that sort of pacifist healer build. One, I like the, going back to sidebars for a second, the peace not pacifism sidebar,
yes,
is a really great one. It's sort of necessary because I've seen I've seen peace/pacifism, that confusion, just tear apart games. right? When someone's like, oh, we can't, you know, no one can do any sort of violence in this world that somehow requires violence sometimes, you know?
You're playing D&D. It's going to require violence a lot. That's just sort of the nature of the game.
Yeah, exactly. So they sort of, they draw that line quite well there. And then they proceed to give you, you know, I'll say that I don't think peace has ever looked quite so good in D&D, right? You know, that you get like that super healing. You get, you know, and then you get bonuses to those powers that don't deal damage. Their 11th level ability is you hit with an attack that doesn't deal damage and you get a +2 to all your defenses there. So you can like get protection. And then you can target things, pacify. Basically, if someone, your target attacks, then they're stunned until the end of the next turn. Just great control effects. And then you mix that with some of the other cleric staples like Fear Command. You've got a pretty cool cleric.
And I found some of the other Paragon paths interesting. I mean, you have some like the Compassionate Healer, which again takes the idea of the cleric as a healer that's already ratcheted up by the new build and makes that even more of your focus. And I found it extra interesting because the artwork they used is a Warforged. You know, they're bringing things from other books into the artwork even. Although there's no Warforged specific classes or anything like that, but you do have some specific classes to other races like the elves and the dwarves, which I also like because it gives you a cleric that feels more like they're part of that world. You know,
Yeah, they've been doing a good job in the power books in general, I think, of trying to rather than always go, all right, there's the, you know, elf ranger. They'll be like, oh, there's the elf paladin, or there's the, you know, tiefling cleric, you know, just things to sort of break up the stereotypes some.
Although two of you were in on the Martial Power review, as I recall, and that was the one where we decided they were trying to make tieflings.
The tiefling.
the martial everything.
Yeah.
That was just sad.
Yeah, sometimes it can get a little forced, but they seem to have even pulled back in the later books. Maybe they heard us talking about that, and they were like, you know, they're right. You know, and they started showing a little restraint with that.
Sure. Well, and to sort of bridge the gap there, and to tease where we're headed, the main picture at the beginning of the next chapter is about the Invoker, and I'm looking at that picture, and I'm not sure if I'm looking at a Deva in armor, or if I'm looking at a Warforged that has little fake wings. Because it could go either way. But we'll talk about the Invoker. I want to take a quick break here to mention that our second sponsor, Gamer's Attic, is where you can find your own copy of Divine Power for under $27. And with the coupon code RADIO, you get another $3 off that purchase if you pick up a little something extra to get your order up to $30. Check it out at gamersattic.com.
Gamer's Attic Attack. We have dice of every stripe, any color scheme and shape you can imagine. Exclusive dice, gold-plated dice, blank dice, label dice, cheat dice, D8 ability dice, crystal dice, time dice, dice within dice, and jumbo foam dice for when you feel the inescapable urge to pelt your fellow players or annoying commercial announcers. And that's just a few of them. We sell enough dice to form a high-intensity plastic bridge from the Earth to the Moon. What's more, any order over $30 gets $3 off when you use the coupon code RADIO. Who wants a set?
I do.
Who else?
Me.
Anyone else?
Why are you ignoring me?
I'm not ignoring you. I'm cutting you off.
What?
You order a new set every day.
So?
Is there a 12-step program for Diceaholics? Because you, sir, have a problem.
That's really strange of you to say.
Green frosted, red speckled, violet glitter, blue translucent. You couldn't say no to these beauties if you wanted to.
I'm not an addict. I could stop collecting marbles anytime I like.
Marbles? You haven't been buying marbles this whole time. You've been buying dice.
That explains why I keep losing the marbles tournament. Those 4- and 6-sided marbles aren't really all that great for rolling.
You're not only a dice junkie, you're dumb, son. Dumb.
So can I get a set?
What'll it hurt? Sure.
Woohoo! Marbles!
Remember, folks, use the coupon code RADIO to get $3 off any order over $30 at gamersattic.com.
Now, Invoker. We have the new class feature, the Covenant of Malediction.
So basically, my understanding of the Invokers is that they're sort of the speakers of the gods. There, and this one is sort of the voice of destruction and bad stuff, I guess, of doom. And it's power, you get a new channel divinity, Maledictor's Doom, and basically it's a Blast 5 power, and then till the end of your next turn, every enemy in it gets minus 1 to defenses and saving throws. And then if you hit them with a fear attack, they get pushed.
Yes.
Squares of reaction. It's not bad, but it's not knocking my socks off. But
well, the negative one to saving throws is nice.
That is nice.
Here's where I think the key to understanding this channel divinity power comes in, though. It's a minor action. And there are so few minor actions that do anything, you know?
That's true.
The fact that it's a minor action means that suddenly you can do that and then hit them with that fear effect in the same round. And because, of course, they're playing this chapter up to this new build, you've got a lot of powers that have fear effects in them. So you have a lot of opportunity to use it.
That's true. That's a good spot on that.
So, any other powers that stand out to us as things to keep an eye on for this, for our invoker? I know there's an invoker in the party in the game I'm playing in right now, and the invoker class seems to be very good at doing what they do. That controller controls the battlefield better than any wizard I've ever seen.
Well, that's because wizards are down a book.
They've got arcane power.
Well, yeah, but all their stuff in the original, well, not all of it, but 2/3 of the stuff out of the player's handbook for the wizards is garbage compared to what the invoker started with.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I have to agree there.
So what new toys does this invoker get?
Lots of I want to throw. I'll let someone do a specific power, but I just want to comment that the names for the powers are probably my favorite in the book. You know, you get the symbol of the broken sword, knives of the soul, the trumpets of Celestia, baleful admonishment. It's just all very, you know, and it seems sort of fitting for a god, for a class that's all sort of speaking, that it sort of has this weird flourish to all the power names.
Yeah,
I like that.
Yeah, these names are impressive. You missed Deluge of Blood, though.
Yeah,
I like the word of fiery condemnation. You know, I picture somebody up, you know, giving a real fire and brimstone sort of speech, huh?
Mm-hmm.
But no, the powers, as well as some of the information in the sidebars, I think gives the invoker some really interesting flavor. You know, the ideas that they give you in terms of how to roleplay the covenant, and the destiny of an invoker, played in with the descriptions and the names of a lot of the powers, I think is just really cool.
Yeah, I mean, I think in this one, I'll admit that when they first came out with the invokers, other than, like, the power standpoint, they're mechanically very good. But in terms of, like, a role, you know, all of a sudden we go from, like you mentioned earlier, from 2 to 4 divine classes. But I was having a hard time differentiating why the invoker was necessarily was sort of different from the cleric. Mm-hmm. And in this book, I'm looking at it, and I got it, right? Like, okay, this is what they're doing. The clerics aren't doing. And so that was nice too.
Yeah, I always struggled with the invoker because of the story behind them. It's sort of like the Avenger, where this class exists to be the exception to the rule, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that always sort of runs a careful line for me, because if it's in the book, anybody can be one, but there shouldn't be that many. Because they're supposed to be the exception, not the rule, you know?
Right.
Being the class that is the voice of a god, that's the exception, not the rule.
Right. But then again,
he had really chatty gods.
Yeah, I suppose.
But as a hero, you're already an exception to the rule, so. Right.
And having seen it in play, it works.
It's just when you get into something like Forgotten Realms, where everyone's an exception to the rules, and is a hero, kind of falls apart.
Well, And I guess part of it is me being concerned about the way I used to play when I was in middle school, you know, when everybody was coming up with their Driz clones and everybody had the, you know, was playing the Drow, which was the exception to the rule of Drow. Well, it sort of creates that slippery slope for people to dive down. But that said, I also have a lot of faith in my players and the people in my game, and they're generally very good at not sort of ruining the storyline for me in that way. So, what about Paragon Paths? Anything there for the Invoker that looks awesome?
I liked Vessel of Ichor and Theurge of the Compact.
Yeah. Those are pretty. They're dark, but very cool.
Vessel of Ichor just seems yucky.
I think it's supposed to.
Well, I suppose. Since you're a vessel of Ichor.
You make it rain blood with your level 20 power. It can go ahead and be icky.
For some reason, the Keeper of the Nine stood out to me, and I think it's the art. Mm. And I think the reason the art stood out to me was because you have the nine symbols that are sort of the theme of the character surrounding the pictures, the head of the picture. But not in the format that you would expect. It's not 3-3-3. It's 1-3-1-3-1.
Yeah.
For some reason, that stood out to me. I don't know why I'm eclectic that way. But it really plays the class itself really play or path I should say really plays up on this idea of the power of words, which is sort of thematic for the class as a whole.
Yeah, they've really gone into that. It seemed like in with PH2, they didn't have the whole "this is the voice of God" thing quite so focused.
Yeah, I sort of got that idea from Player's Handbook 2, but in this book, they really drive it home that this is what this class is. They speak for God, because everything is themed that way.
Yeah, like the Divine Hand one is that way too. I mean, you're basically the hand of the God in the physical realm.
Yeah. Well, and then you've got the Divine Philosopher, which is all about going out and preaching the knowledge of the gods, the Speaker of the Word, the Stone Caller, you know. A lot of them have this very word-focused, the power of words theme to them.
Mm-hmm.
And let's look at our friend the Paladin. He gets to be special because there are two new class features and two new character builds. Apparently, they felt that there was something missing in the Paladin options in the Player's Handbook 1, and so they are trying to make up for it here.
And I would completely agree with them.
Mm-hmm.
The Paladin in Player's Handbook was a little bit more focused and didn't have as much flexibility. That said, I guess I sort of accepted it because it's a Paladin. It's always sort of been more focused from back when they were all lawful good.
Well, my problem with the Paladin in the Player's Handbook 1 is that it wasn't a very good defender. I mean, you're doing some damage if they, you know, they ignore your mark, but not like the fighter is. I mean, the fighter's locking people in place, they're putting them there, so you don't ignore a fighter. The Paladin, you're like, well, whatever.
The Paladin was the first class that really walked the line of having a primary role and a strong secondary role. You know, it was the defender, but it was also kind of a good backup leader.
Yes, but it came close to failing as a defender.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what do they do in this book to fix that?
Divine Sanction.
Oh.
It's a new mechanic. Awesome. A lot of the new powers allow you to put a divine sanction on the target of the power, which is very similar to the divine challenge, in that if they attack someone other than yourself, they're taking 3 plus your charisma modifier damage. But in this case, it's not an interrupt action. So you can do it unlimited number of times per turn.
I'm pretty sure I heard a podcast talking about how this is what Divine Challenge should be.
Yeah.
In
fact, that's a... Oh, sorry. Go on.
in many ways, this is what Divine Challenge was before the last balance, before they put Player's Handbook 1 out at Gen Con last year.
Well, and then they've also put in things with some of the new class features and powers that play into the Divine Sanction even more. Like the Ardent Vow works really well with it. The idea being, let's see, it's you hit a creature, melee touch. The next time you attack the target before the end of your next turn, you gain a bonus to damage rolls equal to 5 plus your wisdom modifier. In addition, whenever you attack the target before the end of the encounter, it is subject to your divine sanction until the end of your next turn. So you've got more and more powers playing into this idea of the divine sanction.
And it's good to mention that you can still use Divine Challenge in addition to Divine Sanction. So you can have two different people marked, or many people marked with them.
Yeah, I was going to throw that out.
But they cannot stack.
No, but
yeah, they don't stack on top of each other.
But you can actually, mark more than one thing at a time, which the fighter had lots of abilities to do that as well. So it helps them catch up to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's, you know, they specifically even mentioned, too, that they sort of mean for you to stack them, so you basically lock yourself into combat, say, with your Divine Challenge target or something, and then you can sort of Divine Sanction a bunch of other ones, so you've got a lot of options with that.
Yeah, well, and it seems like, to go and talk about the other new class feature here, Virtue's Touch sort of goes the other direction with our Paladin, and focuses more on that secondary role of being a leader, where once again, just like Ardent Vow, you're giving up your lay on hands, but you're gaining the ability to remove conditions. So if an ally is blind, dazed, deafened, slowed, stunned, or weakened, you can end that condition with a touch.
Yeah, and that's amazing.
I'm not giving it range.
Yeah, but I mean, replacing lay on hands, I can see why it's touch, and it's still just a minor action.
Well, and again, as a paladin, you're sort of up there in the thick of things anyway, so there shouldn't be too many times where you need it to be a range.
I'm just used to my old group where nobody acted quite the way they were supposed to.
Oh, sure. So any powers there for the paladin that stand out?
Oh, there were many for me, but...
Yeah, pick a couple.
Well, both of the new, or at least Ardent Strike... allows you to Divine Sanction when you hit with it. And this is, as well as a couple other powers, you can use Strength or Charisma for it. Which I find is nice. So you don't have, so it works for either build.
And you can charge with it.
Yes.
Which is always nice, to be able to charge and use a power at the same time.
The level 2 utility... Call of Challenge, Close Burst 3, and you Divine Sanction everyone in that burst as a minor action. You're just laying out the 7x7 square of everyone that's marked by you.
Everybody hit me or suffer.
Right.
That's awesome.
That is very nice.
And they have a lot more close burst attacks also in this.
They do. There's a lot of close bursts I'm seeing as I flip through. Mm-hmm. Or a lot of... even the melee ones and that kind of stuff. You see more and more of that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I do notice that the sidebars for Paladin are pretty severely lacking. I only saw two, and one of them was kind of just a big little fluff piece that doesn't add much.
Yeah.
But
they had to cram in all those powers.
They crammed in a lot of powers, and I'm very happy with the variety of things you get in Paragon Paths. You've got some that are specific to specific faiths, like the Champion of Corallon, but you've also got your Slayers, Demon, and Dragon. You've got some that fit in well with the traditional Crusader or the Knight or all these different things that gives the Paragon Paths, give the Paladin a lot of flexibility. You know, we talked about how the Paladin has... since first edition sort of been pigeonholed as a certain type of character. These Paragon Paths really highlight some of the different directions you can go with a character and still be a paladin.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they've done a great job, in fourth edition in general, but especially in this book. I mean, this book, out of all the classes that got something in this book, the paladin got the best deal in terms of the flavor from the Paragon path and the power and sort of fixing those mechanical things. And it's just so cool that you can finally run, you know, I know a lot of games in previous editions where you sort of house rule that you could have, you know, anti-paladins or neutral paladins and stuff. But to have all these different varieties of sort of these, you know, holy knights is really pretty awesome.
Yeah. Now, we've spent a lot of time looking at the four classes in the first four chapters. But in a lot of ways, I guess my opinion of those four chapters is that it's exactly the sort of stuff I expected, having seen the other two power books, Martial Power and Arcane Power.
Sure.
They didn't give me anything that surprised me. It was like, okay, well, I expected to get more options for my divine classes, and they gave it to me.
But if they surprised you, you'd be all mad.
Not necessarily.
I'm thinking a bad surprise, like, we didn't fix the paladin in this book.
Yeah, no, there was nothing bad in it. But it was also sort of okay. This is what I saw coming, and a lot of times they give me things in books that I didn't expect to see coming. You know, they really surprise me with the new mechanical space they find in the game. The place where I think this book really shines is the last chapter, and that's the Divine Options chapter, which doesn't say much. You know, the title Divine Options doesn't tell you very much about what's in there. But it gives you a lot of new things to play with. Specifically, I want to talk about domains first.
Sure.
Domains are something that go way back in D&D, and then were gone for 4th edition, and now they've brought them back. And basically, the way they've decided to handle domains, I really like. They basically say, if you follow this god, here are the two or three domains that god has access to. And if your god has access to that domain, then you have access to two new feats under each domain. A new channel divinity and a new, what they're calling, domain feat. Which the domain feats pretty consistently give you some sort of bonus and enhancement to using a specific at-will power for your divine class.
Yeah, the type of feat they've done quite a bit of in the past already.
Yeah, they've done some of that. Yeah, but
there's tons of those on Dragon.
What I really like about this is that it gives you, it doesn't restrict anything. It just gives tons of options, but those options are specifically designed to flavor your character to make it feel like a follower of a certain god.
Sure.
You know, if I worship the god of magic and I have access to the Arcana domain, then suddenly I have access to a couple of feats that make my character feel like I worship the god of magic.
Right, and you also get that little kicker of being better at Arcana.
Yes. And I don't have to do it. I don't have to buy into those feats if I choose to go a different way. It's just giving more options.
Right, you're basically saying I focus on this part of my god's roster.
Yes.
Yep.
Or you can choose not to focus on any of them at all.
Right. And I have to say that none of them really overwhelmed me with the mechanical benefits, but there are quite a few that are nice little things here and there.
Uh-huh.
That it's like, oh, that's a cool little effect, or oh, that's a nice little channel divinity feat.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite mechanically, favorite meaning I fear it in my particular campaign. Because in one of the campaigns I run, there are lots of undead and stuff. Mm-hmm. And every time our paladin, you know, the one thing that I think we didn't mention there is, like, paladins were just okay defenders until you have them fight undead and then, like, have some sort of way to deal with, like, radiant damage, which is most of their powers. Mm-hmm. And then they have all these ways to crush them utterly. And then there's the sun domain.
Yes.
Where when you use a power for the domain feat, when you use one of the associated powers, that enemy gains vulnerable 3 radiant at heroic and 5 and then 8 at paragon and epic there. And I just expect that to, like, violate my campaign. is going to get brutal.
Oh, yeah. One that stood out to me was the Pulse of Life feat, which is part of the life domain. mm-hmm. and it allows someone to get, as immediate interrupted, plus 10 to their next death saving throw. So you're mm-hmm. giving them already an automatic success, but in the death saving throw, if you get the 20 or better, then they get to use the surge and stand up. So basically mm-hmm. all they need to do now is roll a 10 or better.
Mm-hmm. So you're almost giving them a surge and healing them.
Right.
It's not quite guaranteed, yep. but there's a good chance. Okay. Mm-hmm. I found the range of different domains fitting really well. You know, I find it interesting that winter has a domain, but none of the other seasons do. You know, as somebody who almost instantly saw the domains, dug into those, and then went to my Forgotten Realms campaign guide and started associating domains with Forgotten Realms gods, I can almost do it without any trouble, but there's a few areas where it's like, oh, I kind of wish there was something to cover that or something to cover this, and I could have sort of blur the lines of something to make it fit. But, you know, that was one of them where it's like, okay, why is there winter but no other seasons?
You know, yeah, well,
thematically, it doesn't make sense, but if you look at the gods that exist and the way they set things up, you can make it work.
Right. Well, you could almost consider the sun the one for summer.
Right.
Or spring.
Yeah. Or you could use life as spring. There's a lot of ways you can go with it. Then they also give you a little section on the different deities and how the different classes play into the deities, using the specific D&D gods, which is interesting. A good read. Not particularly useful to me since most of those gods don't exist in my campaign.
But
there's only four pages.
But as we were talking about earlier, though, what it was, you know, I remember you were mentioning that you ran, like, right back to your Forgotten Realm stuff.
Uh-huh.
And then, like, you know, it's more useful. It's less useful for a specific, you know, because unless you're playing with these gods, it's no use to use the specifics. But it's very useful, the format. You sort of like, okay, let me see if I can take, you know, the Forgotten Realm god and fit them in my own format. Or, you know, take a... you know, my homebrew stuff and sort of make this format for them.
Yeah, you could. It'd be a little bit more work than just writing down three domain names with each god. But yeah,
it's true.
If you're building something homebrew, I could definitely see formatting my homebrew write up of a god in that format. We also get a bunch of new backgrounds. I really like that they've made backgrounds sort of a standard. Since the Forgotten Realms Player's Guide came out, the idea of backgrounds has sort of become an assumed standard of D&D, even though it wasn't in the original Player's Handbook. I like it because it emphasizes the role play aspect of the game, but it gives it a mechanical boost. And so they've got a bunch of new divine based backgrounds. You know, why is it that you're following this god, or are you in that religion, and what kind of follower are you, and that kind of stuff? And there's different backgrounds, you know, that play into that. Are you a convert? Were you a veteran in a religious war? Are you following this religion because it's part of a family tradition? There's lots of different sort of ranges as to why you might be a religious person, and how that's going to play into your character. So what about feats? There's a lot of new feats.
And there's a lot of race-specific feats.
There's a lot of... Yeah, it seems like a lot of the feats are, if you're this class and this race, here's a feat for you.
Which follows the example from the other two power books again.
Yes.
It wasn't as bad as this, though.
Maybe not
arcane, anyway.
Military.
And I wonder if you see more of it now because we have more races now.
Yeah.
You know, because they include Warforged, they include Changelings, they have Devas and Goliaths and Shifters and all those things that we didn't have when those books came out. Because now we've got Eberron, we've got Forgotten Realms, we've got Player's Handbook 2, they've added a lot of new classes to the game.
Right, we have twice as many races to cover.
More than twice as many races.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that's why you see a lot of that in there, because they're trying to provide support for all of these new races and make your Dragonborn Paladin feel more like he's Dragonbornish.
Well, I always like these feats because it gives you a mechanical reason to choose something other than the standard, you know, to not be the dwarven cleric, to be something outside of that, you know, that perfect stat mix or matchup.
Right, yeah, like, in a lot of these cases, there are sort of these feats are sort of something to replace that, meaning like, you know, well, I could take the +2 wisdom class for the cleric, or I could take, you know, this cool, like, I could take, say the drow with the brilliant dark fire, and be able to give guys vulnerability to radiant, you know, some of those things, it's always sort of a hit or miss thing, whether the sort of gimme of the feats or some of the other perks is enough to make up for lacking that stat. But when it works, it's really cool.
Yeah. And one of the things I'm always surprised and impressed with is the fact that they are able to always come up with new multi-class feats for classes that, for classes that we already had multi-class feats for. How many multi-class cleric feats do we have now?
6.
Plenty. But they're all doing new things. You know, they're giving you more options. Yeah. If you want a multi-class cleric, but you wanted to do it so you could pick up this cleric ability and not the one that was standard, you know, now there's a better chance that you're going to be able to have that.
Right.
Any other feats that stand out is something we should talk about.
I wanted to bring up the pacifist healer, just because I've been jabbering about pacifism for the last, you know,
and
however long we've been talking.
And ratcheting up your healing to 11.
Yes. Pacifist healer basically gives you a huge boost to your healing powers, but if you hit someone who's bloodied, it stuns you. Which is so it's a pretty good enforcement mechanism, I think. In terms of, you know, if you're going to commit to this road, you need to be serious about it. But, you know, it's pretty cool. And then they have like a whole range, of different things through Paragon and Epic, that give even more bonuses to your healing. So you can be pretty crazy as a cleric, on the healing front.
And then we get into Epic Destinies, and I think there's some really cool things happening in Epic Destinies. They bring in this idea of avatars, and the avatars tie in well with the domains. Basically, if you are somebody that has access to a certain domain, there's a good chance that there's an avatar of that domain. You know, Avatar of Death is the one that always sounds the coolest, right? But there's, you know, Avatar of Freedom and Hope and on and on and on. And basically, if you have the feat from that domain, you can go into this Epic Destiny and become this implement of the god of this part of their portfolio. It's sort of taking the idea of the Chosen that was introduced in Forgotten Realms Player's Guide and focusing it down on just one part of a god. You're not the Chosen of the god as a whole, but you're the Chosen of this god's wrath or what have you. But they also give you a lot of information on the Chosen as an Epic Destiny as well, beyond what was given to us in Forgotten Realms.
Mm-hmm.
As well as some others like the Exalted Angel and the Saint. So you can... There's Epic Destinies here for everybody.
Yeah, more options are always good.
Mm-hmm. And what's more... What I really like about these Epic Destinies, and maybe it's something that can be done easier because it's a divine book. A lot of Epic Destinies make me scratch my head because it seems like the Epic Destiny should tell me how my character is going to retire. And a lot of them don't.
Yeah. And none of these really retire, do they?
Well, but it sort of makes sense. You know, I don't have to retire because I've become the living embodiment of this god. I've gone on to do that. I'm no longer really of this world. It makes sense for me to leave and not be an adventurer anymore. You know?
Yeah, you know. For the way they sort of put it there, you don't retire when you're a servant of divinity. You ascend.
Yes, you ascend. Right. I think that's a
good way to put it. You sidestep the whole retirement issue.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that's acceptable to me. But the whole I become a teacher thing, I think that was in Martial Power.
Yes. You will not stop bragging on that.
That. Well, it's not. I don't know why they're not still going out and saving the world every time there's a problem. But let's look at rituals to finish off our look at Divine Power. Any rituals that stand out? We've got a handful of them, not a lot.
I didn't even know there were rituals in this book. That's how many there are.
It's like, what, 3 pages of, what, about 10 rituals?
Yeah. I feel like at this point, rituals are the next thing that Wizards really needs to give the treatment to mechanically. And I feel like they're just included in the books for like completeness sakes right now until they either decide, you know what, screw it, which would make me sad because I actually think they're very cool, or they're like, okay, we're going to release the Book of Rituals and just forget about all that other stuff.
And I wonder...
I'd almost rather see that.
I wonder if they're limiting rituals on purpose because you have a little bit of that creep. That issue where in previous editions, every book had a new big section of spells, and then pretty soon there were so many spells all over the place that did different things, and you couldn't track how the balance would be affected when you use things that from different sources, and it caused all kinds of problems.
And then they needed to errata half of them, and they wanted to change the names, and they put out the spell compendium.
Right, or they'd have to put out 3.5 and just do away with all of it.
Or once again, the wizard or cleric is doing everything any other class should be able to do.
Right. So I wonder.
Transformation.
So I wonder if they're not specifically trying to keep rituals a little bit more downplayed and just add a few at a time here and there to fill in some gaps, but not do a whole bunch of them so they don't have that creep of now the cleric or wizard is able to do everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I don't. It doesn't bother me that there's not a lot of rituals, as long as the rituals that are there make sense and play well in the game.
Yeah, my main problem with rituals right now are matters of sort of cost. I find if I can find some way to make them cheap or free for the players, they're much more apt to use them. But when you're looking at that cost, you know, at each level, you always have that thing of, I've got X amount of gold, and do I want to use it to cast like this really cool ritual that only lasts a little bit? Or do I want to use it to get the plus one, like the extra plus one on a weapon that's going to last me for quite some time and help me live? You know, there's always that choice, and having to divide your money up that way is too hard for most players.
And it just sort of happened organically, but my players tend to keep most of the cash in the party in sort of a party fund. And so the idea of, do I want to cast this ritual comes down to, well, is this going to benefit the party in this situation? And if so, let's go ahead and do it. You know, and so they just do it because it's not like the wizard or the cleric is falling behind everybody else.
Right.
You know, because it's coming out of the pool of everybody's.
Right. But it's, you know, everyone being slowed down a little bit rather than the one individual person.
Yeah. And at the same time, I guess that's not really a big concern to me as a DM either, because I look at their items and I reward items accordingly, according to what's in the original DMG. So I sort of make sure that their power level is about where it should be most of the time anyway. So if they save up the money and buy stuff, it's not going to translate to a much more power for very long, right? Because it'll all level out in the end.
It should, but not... I don't know if my group was the exception or not, but we never... No, I take it back. In the 2 or 3 months that we played around level 10, we used 2 rituals. One was a fast travel one, I think off a scroll.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one was just Tendrous Floating Disc for fun. I think it might have also come off a scroll.
And see,
they were just too expensive to use.
Well, and see, my
but we had a stingy DM.
My party didn't use rituals at all, and then all of a sudden, the wizard discovered rituals, and they were using them all the time, and it completely threw me for a loop because they were doing stuff I wasn't prepared for as a DM. You know, it was the, hey, this should be a 2-day travel, and you just did it in 6 hours, and I was planning ambushes along the way and all this other stuff, and you just went around it all.
Well, I've heard that if you're using rituals that are like 5 levels below you, the cost is so little that you don't worry about it at all anyway. So maybe your players just got to that point where they're high enough level that they can start casting those lower level rituals and not worry about it.
And we're getting away from review and a little more into advice here, but I think one of the things I can advise for DMs that want to see more ritual use, when you're giving out treasure, give out spell components.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, give out a ton of spell components, or just lower the price of all of them.
It's a legitimate treasure. You give them that, but you're giving them cash in spell component form, mm-hmm. so they're not going to go out and spend it on stuff, but they've got it there to use for rituals if they want to. They might as well use them.
Right.
Yeah.
Especially if you're fighting any kind of magic user.
Yeah. It makes a lot of sense. So, let's summarize our look at Divine Power by answering the question, who is this book for, and is it worth the $30 cover price?
Paladins.
Yeah, it's for paladins.
Mm-hmm. It's for paladins.
Yeah, I mean, if you have a paladin, you're thinking about a paladin, you might even, cosplay a paladin. Buy the book.
You must have it if you were a paladin. For the other classes, it's definitely good to have. But paladins mm-hmm. must have it.
Yeah.
Okay. Good enough. Any other last thoughts?
It's also a book where, it's a good one for GMs too, because the back of the book is also very strong, ignoring feats and just the different, the talk about sort of gods and pantheons is pretty awesome.
Yeah, I'd say generally speaking, the flavor that this game gives to your divine characters through mechanics, whether it be the backgrounds or the domains and new feats, and a lot of those new feats specific to your race, I think it gives a lot of mechanics to help flavor your character in a really cool way. So if you're playing a divine character, there's a lot here for you. It may not be in the chapter that's listed for your class, though. So look in that last chapter, and that's where I think people can get really excited about this book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right, with that, we will finish episode 112, Divine Power. You can email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com or visit the forums when they finally get back up. Review the show on iTunes or go out and tell people about the show. That helps bring more people in, and I appreciate that. And don't forget to consider checking out the Tomes Amazon store or RPG shop affiliate link for products discussed on the show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air. And you can find all of that at thetomeshow.com. You can also find Quinn and Jake at, give us your URL.
At will, @will.omnivangelist.net.
And that will be linked in the show notes as well. And Will, you can find here at thetomeshow.com as he continues to join us as our senior contributor. And by the light of Paylor, this has been episode 112, Divine Power of
the Tome, the Tome, the Tome, the Tome, the Tome, the Tome, the Tome.
I'm on the wall.